All right. Welcome back, everybody. It is once again the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin here with you alongside Dom. Dom, something very special for the folks today. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Very excited for this and for the subject matter, the tournament that is about coming very soon as we record this. I don't think it's going to be up in time, but luckily, as it's in progress, people can go back and listen to this, and no spoilers or anything like that. So we should be good to go.
What we are talking about today, at the time that you are hearing this, or more likely, it has started at the time that you are hearing this already, is the Jeopardy All-Star Tournament that begins Wednesday, February 20th, 2019, to hashtag date this podcast. Yes, the same date as the Survivor Edge of Extinction premiere. We have this group of all-time Jeopardy legends coming back to compete in a team format, which I believe is the first they've ever done in Jeopardy, right? Have there ever been any kind of team situations that you're aware of?
Not that I can recall. I'm sure there's been a one-off special or something where a similar format took place, and they are fans of experimenting with things, which you really have to be when the show has been on for this length of time. But this is the first real team tournament that we're getting to watch, and I'm really pumped up for it.
Yeah, not only excited for the format, which we will get into shortly, but as mentioned, this is a true list of just the all-time giants of Jeopardy that are coming back for this, and of course a lot of more recent players that have been really impressive as well, and so this is for the first time in frankly years, as excited as I've been to dive into Jeopardy. It's something that we've toyed with talking about on a podcast before, but this is the first time we've ever been really inspired to do so. And
well,
I would say
I remember back in 2014 we first spitballed the idea of some kind of Jeopardy coverage, and at the time it seemed like an interview with Roger Craig was in the cards, and who knows, it might be again after all of this is said and done, but that never materialized when we ended up not getting up off our asses and doing that Jeopardy podcast. And so now 4 or 5 years later, we're finally summoning up the courage to talk about it for the first time. And back then we discussed, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to rank players? Are we going to do one of these Big Brother or Survivor style lists of the best games of all time, best players of all time? And since then, both of those categories have had many, many new candidates added to them. And most of those candidates are in this tournament. So it's a really exciting time. And so we will get onto our own draft shortly, and that will involve talking about the draft that all of these captains did a few months ago. But before we do that, we'll talk about the format here quickly, because it's a little unusual, and as you'd expect, they've had to shuffle a few things around to make Jeopardy work in a team format. So the way this is going to work is we're going to start with two matches. Each of those is going to have two games, and the two-day point total will decide who advances to the finals. Three teams are going to take part in each of these matches, and for each round of Jeopardy, so Jeopardy, Double Jeopardy, and then Final Jeopardy, each team will have to field one of their three members, and you can't put someone in the same position in back-to-back games in the same match. So if you put Roger Craig in Double Jeopardy, he has to go into either Jeopardy or Final Jeopardy in the second game. And so the first two matches will each send one person, or one team rather, to the finals, and then the highest scoring teams who didn't win their round will come back to decide the wildcard spot, the third spot in the finals, and then those three teams will compete for the title, and I guess the money, which is the less important part here.
How much is the money? What's the prize?
So it's $1 million first prize. I imagine split evenly between the team members, but I don't know if the captain's got some like separate stipend or something. It wouldn't surprise me. But either way, Brad Rutter may be adding exactly $333,333.33 to his lifetime winnings. So
I was going to say, it just gets split. $1 million goes to Brad no matter what, and enjoy the tournament.
So there are some interesting strategic elements to this, which we'll get onto in a second. But the way they've distributed the airtime here is a little curious. So the way they're doing this is, for each of the matches, the first game, they're devoting an entire episode to the Jeopardy round, the single Jeopardy, if you like, where I imagine a lot of that is going to be extended interviews with the team members and a few other things. And they're going to dress it up and make it a full production. So it's not just going to be drawing out one round of Jeopardy for as long as they can. But then they're packing Double Jeopardy and Final Jeopardy into one episode. And then for the second game, it's just a normal Jeopardy episode where all three rounds are within the same 25-minute block. But you would think, without getting into too far into the weeds here, that what you'd want to do is put the member that you think is weakest, or I guess you wouldn't put it that way to them, but they all know what the deal is, I think. You're going to want to put your weakest member in the Jeopardy round, which potentially means if you do that for the first game, the longest period of airtime is going to be devoted to the weakest members of the roster. And it is an all-star game, so the weakest members are still far and away above the average Jeopardy cast. But let's say your Ken Jennings or your Brad Rutter is squirreled away in Final Jeopardy, they might get only a few minutes of airtime, if that, compared to the, you know, whichever C team member you have to field instead.
So you may have just been using Final Jeopardy as an example, but to me, when I first heard about the way that this was going to be structured, which, full disclosure, was about 20 minutes ago, my overwhelming takeaway in terms of what the strategy was for what I would imagine the strategy is going to be for each team is we, without a doubt, need our two heaviest hitters to be playing our double Jeopardy rounds. And the weakest player will do single Jeopardy and then hopefully a final Jeopardy where we already have the game in the bag.
Okay, so yeah, I guess that makes sense then. If you think that anyone who could make it to this level is going to be, you can rely on them most of the time to get that Final Jeopardy right, then it makes sense to put them there, and then the less important or the less valuable full Jeopardy round, and then if you have your Ken or your Brad, you just have them answer as many clues as possible, because that gives you the greatest comparative advantage, if you like.
Yeah. And I also think it will be a factor making sure that you get your biggest wagerers with the greatest chance of hitting a daily double, which is obviously in the Double Jeopardy round.
Yeah, although if that wagerer is on your team, then in theory they can influence the wagering strategy of your other members.
So right, but I want to see, I want people I know will pull the trigger when the time comes, which there are certainly plenty of.
Do you think that the team format might inspire people to play a little bit more conservatively, where in a single tournament, if you mess it up, then that sucks and you're probably gutted and you look like an idiot on national TV potentially, but at least the ramifications are self-contained. Whereas if you do that in a team tournament, if you pull the trigger and you get it wrong and your entire team's hopes just go down the drain, then there's an added sense of responsibility or guilt for that, I suppose.
I think, yeah, without question, no one's going to want to be the person who put it all on the line for the team and ended up getting it wrong and basically made what the other two members did almost irrelevant. Like, that would for sure suck. But I would guess that there's going to be at least one member of every team who is a pretty big wagerer and who will be almost insisting upon, especially in a tournament format, that being the general game plan for all team members.
I think it really depends on the team, though, because looking down at who is in what team, some of the big wagerers are clumped up together. So there was a fun anecdote from the draft, which I watched earlier, where Austin, who I was not too familiar with before watching that draft and doing the research for this episode, but he apparently has a reputation for not just being a big character, but also being a big wagerer. And so when he was giving his speech about who he picked and why, he picked Roger, and he opened that by saying, "I'm known for making these crazy bets and just for making mad decisions," in the spirit of that, or something to that effect. "Roger Craig, come on down." And so Roger dutifully just kind of trotted along and shook his hand, and I was very composed and a little po-faced about the whole situation, because I think he knew that while what he does seems reckless to the unenlightened viewer, it's a carefully calculated risk. I mean, Roger, personality-wise, is not the type to be a maniac and do stupid things. And when he's making these big bets, despite what issues you might take with some of them,
I am not a truther. I'm not a flat earther when it comes to that kind of game theory idea.
Okay, well, that's reassuring. Despite what you or other pundits might have to say about his wagering strategy, it is very intentional, and it is it's something which he has worked on and takes pride in. So for Austin to just bring that under his own umbrella as, "Oh, I'm going to pick someone else who just clicks buttons for no reason," I'm not sure if that's Austin upholding his brand or if Roger was in on that or what level either of them was on, but that could cause some tension in the team if that's the guiding philosophy there.
I mean, it may have also been the case that, hey, it's my pick now and Roger Craig is still on the board, so how could I possibly go any other direction? And here's a fun reason why.
Yeah, obviously Roger's resume speaks for itself, and he is the clear pick when you have access to him. Although you can make arguments for a few other people, but I think giving that, unless Roger, you've coordinated this or colluded beforehand, or you take him aside and give him the sanguine speech of why it had to be this way afterwards. I don't know. I think that's going to lead to some bad blood right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dom, enough dilly-dallying. I guess we determined off-air the way this draft is going to go is with six teams, it's kind of weird doing a true pure snake draft. It seems a little unfair to the second person. So this is going to go A, B, B, A, B, A in terms of selection order. And Dom won the coin flip pregame, and he has decided that he wants to be B. So I will be making the first pick. And I believe, obviously, the way this is going to work, we didn't go over this ahead of time, but I assume it goes without saying, this is whoever just, we're drafting the entire team, and whoever gets the team that wins the whole tournament wins the draft.
Yeah, and just to quickly run down how the actual draft itself went, so you have a frame of reference. Buzzy had the first pick, took Alex Jacob. Austin then took Roger Craig.
Quick sidebar, while we're on that, just I will not do this at, I don't think, any other point. But to me, when I first saw the list of people that were the captains for this tournament, and I did not see who the 12 field players were initially, my immediate thought upon seeing that Roger Craig was not a captain was, oh, Roger must not be in this tournament, because of course he would be a captain if he were there. So as to go back to these first two picks that you just ran down, what did you make of Alex Jacob going number one overall as Roger Craig stood there on the stage waiting?
So, well, that's an interesting topic that we'll get into, but as I think I agree with what you're putting down here, which is I don't think there should be a Team Buzzy in this tournament. I think Roger Craig should have one of those captain spots, and now Alex Jacob probably should have another one too. And it's maybe notable that Buzzy and Austin are the two people who they should kick out to get those titles for themselves, and those are the first two captains here who get those picks and take them off the board.
Ooh, do you smell a conspiracy, Dom?
Wait, what do you mean?
That the two captains you would take off the board happen to get the top two draft selections to almost balance that out?
What possible use could that conspiracy serve? Like, why would you not just have AJ and Roger Craig in there instead? Probably not picking Buzzy or Austin. So there's no symmetry there. But yeah, I don't see... Explain yourself.
Because Buzzy and Austin are much more recent popular players.
I don't know how popular they are. Certainly Austin has caused some controversy. I know there are people who are not Buzzy fans, to put it mildly, but yeah, there's certainly some of the big names of the Jeopardy franchise. They stick in your recent memory, and it's weird to talk about recency bias on a show which has been around for literal decades. If any show has been around long enough to have a battle of the decades, then you know they're doing something right. But I don't know if someone like Roger Craig, for instance, who he was on Battle of the Decades in 2014, was it? Something like that. Does he count as a recent player? Like, in the grand scheme of things, he clearly is. But I don't know if the average Jeopardy viewer who is, I imagine, in a retirement home at this point, how well he fits in their, like, time horizon, if you like.
Right. I think he is, compared to Buzzy and Austin, certainly, like, at least a middle-era kind of player. And that would, I do genuinely think that you're right. If this tournament were held 5 years from now, I think he probably would have had a better chance of potentially being one of the captains in their place.
Do you think there's a level of, among the captains, maybe less so, because they all know their Jeopardy, they know their stuff, and even the lesser names on this list, that they will have done their research, and unlike you, they will have put a full draft board up, and they know who they want to pick when if they get the chance to. But among the average viewer, I think they clearly know Ken and Brad. Maybe they don't even know Roger, which is a scary and depressing thought to have. But some of these older names for sure, like Pam, for instance. How many of the... maybe they remember her from her teen tournament win or whatever, like back in the day when a young Pam Mueller in grainy graphics was accepting a trophy from Alex Trebek. But I don't know how many of these names actually resonate with the wider Jeopardy audience at this stage.
Probably not a ton. I would imagine, frankly, most people watching this program will only know Ken Jennings.
Okay. Do you think that they experimented with the setup to draw more people in who, by definition, will not know most of the people on that stage?
I do think so, and I know we have gotten far away from Dom attempting to read off the draft order,
yes.
But this does tie into a larger point that I wanted to make. But Dom, continue the draft, and then I will make that point. Just roll through the rest of the names. Sorry.
Okay, so just to recap, Buzzy picked Alex Jacob, Austin picked Roger Craig, Ken Jennings picked Matt Jackson, Julia picked Ben Ingram, Colby took Pam, Brad took Larissa Kelly and then David Madden on the wheel, and Colby took Alan Lynn, Julia took Seth Wilson, Ken took Monica Tu, Austin took Lennon Cooper, and then Buzzy got Jennifer Giles by default.
Okay, thank you, Dom. So there are your teams, and we will get certainly more into each of those players as they come off the board. But the thing that I wanted to get to that ties into what you just brought up is I think, frankly, one of the main reasons that this is like the fifth kind of all-star tournament I think that we've seen over the last 10 or so years, I guess, is Jeopardy recognized in whatever it was, 2004, 2005, whenever they did that tournament where Ken got just the bye right to the finals and then Brad beat him in the finals. Ken was already, of course, at that point, like a household name in America. And I think Brad beating him really cemented Brad's kind of Jeopardy place in history as well. And they were smart to see these guys are still, I think at that point, like 32 years old or so, both of them. And they have over the years found reasons to bring them back to play against Watson. They did the Battle of the Decades that miraculously and beautifully and perfectly came down to Ken against Brad once again, with Roger Craig in there putting in quite a bid himself. And I really do think that Jeopardy recognizes, as they've gotten past kind of what I guess I will refer to, perhaps incorrectly, but at least in my mind, as the kind of Roger Craig and beyond era, where people really do understand the math behind wagering and go in there with a really aggressive game plan, I think they have gotten a really solid stable of super competitive players that would absolutely love to have more chances at Jeopardy and are all, as far as I could, at least the vast majority of them are well under 50 years old and could easily come back and play a lot of these kind of Jeopardy returning player tournaments for years to come. And I think that could be a recurring thing, almost the same way it is on like MTV's The Challenge, one of my favorite things where, one of my favorite shows on right now, where this tournament we're watching right now, I'm sure a lot of the people playing in it were viewing this as potentially at least almost an audition process to kind of print their own Ken Jennings lifetime invitation to all future Jeopardy events.
That's a really interesting thought. Yeah. Do you think we could have a challenge crossover where like Johnny Bananas could go in the All-Star Tournament and then Roger Craig could go in the Challenge House?
I don't know if that would be the best or worst crossover event. It would certainly be the most ambitious crossover to fire some shots at Marvel.
But yeah, potentially of all time. But I'm not sure if it would be good TV for the right reasons or good TV for the wrong reasons. But either way, I would tune into to both halves of that.
I would at least watch the premiere to be sure. Okay, Dom. So finally, let's at long last get into, or not.
I will just echo what you said, where even if Jeopardy had no new contestants for the rest of time, I think they could still air a solid tournament of some kind every year, every few years, and just get the same people coming back, and it really wouldn't get old. The roster runs so deep at this point that you could replenish that with, even if Ken and Brad swore off Jeopardy for life for some reason, that would not be fatal. You would have this next generation rising up to take their place.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, I guess before we, one final thing before we dive into the draft, sorry, I'm really sorry, audience. I think I referenced Ken as, I guess, like the Johnny Bananas figure, where obviously I can't imagine they would ever have a tournament without Ken, and that he wouldn't want to play it unless he's like hosting the show himself some years down the line. And I would guess also that Brad has got to be in that same pantheon as well. I mean, how many tournaments does he have to win to get a shot to keep the undefeated streak alive? And I was wondering, who else do you think is potentially in that conversation? Because I could see it being the case that Julia Collins could be there as well.
As the next Jeopardy host or announcer?
No, no, no. As in, has a lifetime pass for as many of these tournaments as they run.
Oh, I think Julia definitely does. I would say one of the Alex Jacob, Roger Craig, Matt Jackson, Ben Ingram quadruplet, if you like, could be in the mix too, depending on which one of them emerges triumphant. But beyond that, are there any obvious names that come to mind for you? I think at that point, it becomes less about results and more about just filling a need that the tournament has. So Colby, for instance, in terms of results alone, is never going to be up there. But I think he is, you know, at the front of their Rolodex for every tournament they have, just because he is this big dynamic personality who's very memorable and, you know, fills a need that few other people can fill.
Totally. And I would imagine, you know, as long as Pam Mueller keeps putting up good results, I'm guessing they're happy to keep having her back as well.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, sure. All right. So actually,
I would say Leonard Cooper might be one of those rising stars now who, depending how he does in this All-Star tournament, this might be his audition for the big leagues to get that permanent lifetime pass.
Yeah, so hand up. Never seen Leonard Cooper play, but excited to give him a look. And just because it got kind of alluded to, I did want to bring up, so I'll do it now, because I'm sure I would forget if I didn't. I think my favorite subplot, like maybe the thing I'm looking more forward to than the tournament itself, is Brad and Ken jockeying for Trebek's job. Both of them, as far as I can tell, very badly want this gig, and it does seem like at a certain point it's going to go somewhere.
Do you think it's definitely going to go to one of them?
No, but I do think they both have a chance and know it.
Or rather, do you think it definitely is going to go to a former contestant, or is some other bigwig from the TV industry going to come in and snipe it away from them?
I think there is a very real chance that it would not go to a former contestant, if not a potentially overwhelming chance that it would not go to a former contestant. And actually, while we're on it, a take I've had for years, all the way back since his days serving as the host of the World Series of Pop Culture, I want Pat Kiernan as the next host of Jeopardy. Neither here nor there, I'm sure. Most people have probably not heard of him, but he's a fantastic, I think he's like a news anchor now. He would be my guy. But not the conversation we're here to have, Dom. Let's actually do this draft now for real.
Are you sure? And then nothing else you want to get off your get off your mind before that?
I think I'm good. So as I think I mentioned already, I have the first pick here, and then Dom will go second, third, and fifth, and I will also get the number four and the default pick. And I should by now know where I'm going, which I don't, but.
By the way, this is why I decided to go second, because I when you said you weren't prepared, I thought you would have to flounder around to make a first pick, and then I could maybe reap the benefits of that afterwards. Yeah, enough.
Yeah, you really knocked that one out of the park. Although, honestly, the joke may be on you, because
perhaps
with the first overall pick, it is at least based on Jeopardy history to be 100% results oriented, probably insane to go any direction other than Team Brad, which I think I will lock in as my first pick. For anyone unfamiliar with Brad Rutter, he's a name that's come up a bunch on this podcast before. Brad Rutter, I think it was the year 2000, won his five games, and then that was still at the point where he had to stop. He came back, he won his Tournament of Champions, and at that point in time, he was like 22 or 23 years old, substantially younger than Dom is today. Very unimpressed by anything Dom's ever accomplished. But Brad has subsequently come back for the $1 Million Masters, the Ultimate Tournament of Champions, the Battle of the Decades, and to play against Watson. And his results were a win in every single one of those tournaments, except for the match against Watson, which does not at all count as real Jeopardy and was probably the most like unwatchable week in the show's history.
Yeah, Brad still, after two decades, has not lost a match of Jeopardy to a human yet, which is staggering. It is just absolutely mind-blowing. Although I do wonder, as you alluded to, Brad had to stop after five games. That was the rule at the time. If he had just been able to go on uncontested, do you think he would have broken Ken Jennings' winning streak? Would he still be here right now after thousands of games? Like, where do you think that would have cut off?
Well, according to my wagering edgelord theory, he'd be a huge favorite compared to any of these morons betting so big because he was before the crazy wagering time, where I would guess he would have been a favorite to piece together a pretty solid winning streak, although I have a hard time saying any 23-year-old is going to put together 75 games.
Maybe, although, how old was Ken at the time that he went on his insane run?
I think he was 30 or 31, younger than me today, which is super depressing.
Yeah, so neither impressed by anything that you have ever accomplished, or will accomplish from here on out. But yeah, I think Brad, even back then, though, people realized, like, this kid is something else. Like, he is on another level than anyone we've seen on the show before. And I know that there were times that he came close to losing, and if, you know, in the butterfly effect theory of the universe, you change one clue in one game in 2001 and or 2000, and everything about Jeopardy history might be different now. But I think Brad could have pieced a pretty solid streak together. And as the top of the ticket, there's no one else you'd rather have. If in the dark, if you didn't know who any of the captains had picked, even knowing the draft order, you couldn't really go wrong choosing Brad, because he is going to carry a lot of weight for whatever team he's on.
Well, speaking of draft order, never run bad Brad, I thought, at least, in picking the number 6 draft spot and getting the corner, because I really do think it's going to be meaningful having the strongest, to put it in extraordinary air quotes, weakest link. And by no means do I think any of these people are weak links on any of these teams, but I think having that corner spot is right where I would want to be, because I frankly don't think the difference between the top pick in the first round and the bottom pick in the first round is potentially nearly the same as the first pick in the second round and the last overall pick.
That's okay. That's fascinating, because 20 minutes before starting this, I think I would have agreed with you. However, something that you said earlier, I think, has talked me into believing exactly the opposite. So I'm sure.
So, which is, you can put them on. Double Jeopardy is insanely important in this format.
So what I'm saying is, going back to, because when I said if you squirrel away Ken or Brad on Final Jeopardy, I assumed that was something that teams might actually want to do. But now that you contested that and said, well, why not just have your heavy hitters play for the longest stretch of time in Jeopardy and then Double Jeopardy, that seems so incredibly obvious that I feel stupid now for ever thinking it could be any other way. And
well, no,
it's
to clarify, it's specifically, I think, at least based on my initial poorly thought out thoughts, when you explained the rules to me, as I mentioned, which was like 10 minutes before we came on air, I think it's borderline mandatory to have your two strongest players playing the Double Jeopardy round.
Right. And to talk myself back into your version of events yet again, the way they set the tournament up means that in at least one of those two games, that it has to be that your weakest player is playing one of those rounds. And so you don't want to essentially forfeit that stage of the game and have to make that up later, even if it's, you know, in Double Jeopardy and then Final Jeopardy. So depending on how big that gap is between the top of the field and the bottom of the field, it may be best to be in the middle somewhere, or to be, in Brad's case, literally in the middle and have that wheel and be able to take two very solid, if potentially unremarkable given the competition, names off the board.
Right. Like, what I was getting at is, I feel David Madden as a second round pick is insane value, essentially, in terms of when you're going to have to, again, it feels so weird framing it in terms of anyone not being able to carry their weight, because these are obviously some of the best players of all time, but just in purely comparative terms, it seems like having the advantage in the battle between the last round picks, if they're kind of going head to head with each other, is going to be a wider gap, like a bigger difference maker than among the captains or the first round picks.
Yeah, and let's talk about Brad's team as a whole then, because it is easy to focus on Brad at the expense of everyone else, but Larissa Kelly and David Madden, I'd say it's hard to ask for a better team. You clearly could put one together if you had access to the full roster here, but given the position he's in and the position the rest of the captains are in, yeah, maybe Brad just got away with the steal here and he's the heavy favorite, more so than he would have been already just by being Brad Rutter.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with Larissa Kelly, but I certainly trust Brad to have done his homework and know what he was doing with this pick. So I feel totally fine on that front. And David Madden, 20-game win streak, hard to argue with on the corner there in the second round.
Do you think it matters when that streak came? Because in this competition, we also have one Julia Collins with a 20-game win streak, and of course Ken's, which is impossible not to mention. But do any of those have an asterisk by them based on just when they took place? So does Julia doing that in the mid-2010s look more or less impressive than David Madden doing that in the early 2000s?
I would say there's no wrong way to piece together a 20-game win streak on Jeopardy, and anyone capable of doing so is an absolutely justifiable pick in the last round of this tournament.
I would agree, but you do often hear it said that Ken would not be able to piece together anywhere near the same length of win streak today or even 5 or 10 years ago, and that doing it in the mid-early 2000s was maybe the only time something like that could possibly have happened, however unlikely it still was.
Because of his competition being stronger at wagering, or what?
Well, stronger at wagering and just having a deeper breadth of knowledge and having more experience with Jeopardy, and there being just more resources out there for the aspiring trivia buff. Like, if you're trying to go on Jeopardy in the 1990s, right, you don't necessarily have the internet as it exists today to learn all of this information. Whereas now, like, if you want to go on Jeopardy and be the best at Jeopardy that you're going to be, you can do that, whatever sacrifices it might take. Like, the information is out there at your fingertips at all times.
Right. I believe that's, like, literally what Alex Jacob did, is he decided in, like, 2012, I want to get good at trivia, and he just went on the Jeopardy archive and to prep for the show, figured out, you know, went through every question they've ever asked to figure out what comes up a lot.
Right. So if you're Ken Jennings and you've already had a 10-year-long history with College Bowl and Quiz Bowl and all these other trivia contests, you're going to have a much bigger edge over the average person who watches Jeopardy on TV and has a decent just base of knowledge from being a curious person in life and passes the exam and gets on the show and then is unfortunate enough to run into the juggernaut that is Ken Jennings, who is going to quickly end any of their own hopes for maybe a 3 or 4 game winning streak.
Yeah, okay, I buy that. So I guess I am more impressed with Julia's win streak to incorporate that logic, but only slightly so. I'm certainly not trying to take anything away from David Madden, even though I guess he was playing against softer competition.
Yeah, and David Madden, certainly no slouch, someone who you would not be shocked to see as a captain in his own right, and Julia definitely cemented one of those captain spots for herself, so maybe that comparison is already a little warped there. But let's not sleep on Larissa Kelly either, because I think she might be the dark horse of this competition. I, like you, was not that familiar with her before researching this, but she's someone who, if you look down her list of Jeopardy records, Jeopardy titles, and so on, she's someone who either held important records for a length of time before they were then snatched away or improved upon, or came very close to holding certain records, and there, but for the grace of God, again, you change one clue and everything changes. She's someone who the people who know a lot about Jeopardy seem to really respect her a lot, and that includes Brad Rutter, who decided that of all the people left, including someone with his own 12-game win streak, including some other good competitors, she was someone that he certainly wanted on his team. And she
to quickly tack on to that, I remember I watched that same Facebook video of them drafting, and when Brad made his pick, he made the comment that were it not for some sort of unlucky break, she could have done way more damage.
Right. And she, to this day, works in... she runs an academic quiz bowl, so she is in, even though her run was 10 years ago at this point, she is in top fighting shape for this. This stuff is all at the forefront of her mind, and she maybe has more just relevant practice than any of the people out there who don't professionally work in that kind of trivia setting.
So very excited to have Brad as my number one overall pick. Hard to argue with, I would say. So don't give me too much heat if that one doesn't pan out. Dom, you now have consecutive picks. Which direction are you thinking about going?
Okay, so I don't know if this is a smart pick, and maybe I already made the biggest mistake of this draft by choosing to go second, and we'll see how that works out. But for my first pick, I'm actually going to take Team Julia. I think top to bottom, this might be the most talented team, with the possible exception of Brad's. And so that level of consistency across the board is really what you're going for here. Julia herself, 20-game win streak, arguably, or maybe not so arguably, the best female player of all time. And that's only the top of the ticket. You look at Ben Ingram and Seth Wilson. Ben Ingram beat Julia in that tournament of, I think, Tournament of Champions, or whatever that tournament was called, has super tournament experience in his own right. And I think it's only because he hasn't had another chance to face off against the likes of Alex Jacob, Roger Craig, Matt Jackson, that he's maybe an underdog in this competition, if anything.
I know, at least I see on Twitter, Alex and Ben Ingram for a long time tweeting back and forth at each other. So I'm guessing there have been years of preparing for a potential showdown and exchanging ideas about how to play optimal Jeopardy. So I would have the utmost faith in Ben Ingram to go in there super prepared and confident. And I'm totally with you. I think both Ben and Seth Wilson are super value picks here for Julia. Getting Seth Wilson at 9 is mind-blowing to me.
Right. And Seth Wilson, I assume you know more about him than I do.
I watched his initial run and I thought he was a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, a lot of fun, but also, is he ultimate tournament of whatever material, do you think?
I would say so.
Okay. And that's maybe more than you can say for someone who, Colby, not to give away anything about my potential board, but Colby could have taken Seth Wilson off the board and chose not to. And to be fair, Colby has very different priorities when it comes to life in general and also a competition like this. So based on his own standards, I think that pick might make sense. But to be able to scoop up Seth Wilson, I don't think Julia was expecting that, and I'm sure she would have been very happy about it.
Right. I think this is, much like Brad, an extremely balanced team.
Yeah, so there's no real weak link. That everyone on this team, you would be happy sending into any round and putting them up against the best of them to do it.
Totally.
All right, so that's going to account for my first pick. For my second pick here, it's really hard not to go with Team Ken, so I'm just going to take the leap and go with that.
I thought there was some chance that Ken Jennings, Matt Jackson, and Monica Tew, I'm going with your pronunciation on that last name, could potentially fall to me, but not meant to be.
You were drawing dead for that from the outset.
I was so excited to have. That is, without a doubt, the funniest team.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And one thing to be said about most of these teams is there are some great personalities here. So Brad Rutter, maybe the best Jeopardy player of all time and may retain that title for eternity. But he's also just a lot of fun. And I know that some people think he's kind of an asshole or whatever, but he's a fun asshole, right? He's a guy you like to root against rather than hate to root against.
And by the way, even if he doesn't win here, his team lost. He didn't personally lose. He's still never lost an individual game of Jeopardy.
Yeah, if he wins, then he won it for them. And if he lost, then it was David Madden's fault. You know, we could write that one off. But yeah, Brad has a very Colin Stone-esque outlook on the world, I would say. And he's a lot of fun. There's always some good banter with Trebek. So very excited just to have Brad back on my TV again in some capacity, regardless of what trivia-related things may be going on at the time.
And I assume you also mean Ken, the person you just selected.
Yeah, Ken's fantastic. But yeah, let's talk about Team Ken here. So Ken picked up Matt Jackson and Monica Tew. Matt Jackson, I think, is worth talking about in more detail here because he had one of these incredible runs and great tournament performances, but that came bracketed between exactly the same thing with more flashy quality to them from Alex Jacob and Ben Ingram and so on. So when we look at maybe the second tier here, where you have the ultimate pantheon of Ken and Brad, and if you want to lump Roger in there, then you, I think that's perfectly fair. But then you have Alex, Matt, and Ben maybe vying for that secondary position.
Yeah, I'm with that. And by the way, for anyone who missed the Facebook draft special that they did where the captains drafted their teams live, the easy standout was Matt Jackson from the live show when it was his turn to like pitch himself before the draft began. He had like all of his career stats ready to go. And if I was one of those captains, that's exactly what I would want to see, is him talking about like his double Jeopardy hit rate and things of that nature. This guy is exactly who I want on my team.
Yeah, Matt does not like to lose. So if there's any amount of want it more in this tournament, then Matt's got that nailed down.
A very entertaining top of the ticket there. Ken Jennings, obviously his resume speaks for itself. But what do we know about Monica?
Well, I will just add on Matt that he's maybe not the most dynamic personality of the tournament, but he still adds something insofar as he is a cyborg built to win at Jeopardy, and he does that. And if you look past what the qualities that people find it very easy to make fun of, he is actually just a super nice guy who everyone who interacts with him seems to come away with a very positive impression. So, you know, first impressions aside, he's someone who is easy to root for, I think, or should be easy to root for. And it's, and not just because he's very good at Jeopardy. So it's you know, it's always nice to root for the winner, and Matt makes it easy on both fronts.
Yeah, I mean, when Matt Jackson gets a head of steam going on Jeopardy and like is on a roll rattling off answer after answer, there's nothing finer than the facial expressions and like nodding at the board and things like that. It's awesome.
Monica Chu is, at least for me, a fairly unknown quantity. The hair certainly makes her stand out. And Ken said in his wrap up for why his team is going to win, not only do we have myself and Matt Jackson, we also have the best hair in the room, which shots fired at Alex Trebek, I suppose. But outside of that, it's hard to argue with.
Shots fired at Leonard, man.
I mean, that afro is something else, but he and Monica, clearly the only two vying for that title.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see a fro-off between Leonard and a 23-year-old Alex Jacob.
Yeah, Alex has some solid hair. I remember Colby having some good styling back in the day as well.
Yeah. All right, so there is Team Ken off the board as well.
Let's comment about that depth of the roster again, because you picked Team Brad, I picked Team Julia, because we think that you have a solid A, a solid B, and also a solid C. How solid do you think Ken C actually is? So, you know, on the overall draft board, how big is the gap between, I guess, the bottom of the tier above might be Seth Wilson or David Madden, maybe even Larissa Kelly. And then when you drop down, how far is the drop to the Monica Chews and the others of that bunch?
So I have no idea on specifics. The last few players who were picked were people whose names I don't think I'd ever really heard before. And I'm looking at Monica's resume now. She was the 2012 college championship winner, and she made the quarterfinals of the 2013 Tournament of Champions. And that is essentially why I was saying I thought Brad getting someone like David Madden in the top of the second round is potentially a huge difference maker compared to the people with so much less experience on Jeopardy.
So, yeah, I think if you had to pick out a clear bottom tier, it would be Jennifer Giles, who came to this via the Teachers Tournament, which I think is a fun wrinkle to have in there, where you get the entire cinematic universe of Jeopardy, if you like, represented in this tournament. But what it does mean is that the people who qualified by some of those exceptional means, they're entering shark-infested waters here, where you have to imagine if you get to a Jeopardy round and it's Jennifer Giles up against, like, let's say, Ben Ingram and Ken Jennings, that's essentially a two-horse race, right? And it's going to be hard for them to get a word in edgeways over there, unless they're up against other people from that same tier, in which case they're still likely to be one of the upper echelon players there, who is just going to dominate that round completely, and they're not going to get their chance to shine. So in that respect, when it is that uneven, then like obviously you're glad to have the true all-stars there, but it means that you really need to make sure that the floor is high as well. Otherwise, it's just not going to be a competition still.
Right. And in fairness, Colby Burnett got his origin story in the teacher tournament. And as mentioned, Brad Rutter was in his early 20s when he won his Tournament of Champions. It is certainly within the realm of possibility for me that plenty of these later picks can go in there and hang. It's just hard for me, based on what I've seen at this hour, to have nearly the same degree of confidence.
Yeah, I would love it if Jennifer Giles is the Kyung-hoon of the Jeopardy All-Star game, but I don't know how realistic that is, because as you say, Colby may have cut his teeth in the Teachers Tournament, but he then came back and won the Tournament of Champions for real this time. And Brad, yeah, he got his start when he was young, but he has literally never lost a match against a human. So there is a level of proof there that there isn't with some of these competitors. So maybe this is what puts Leonard Cooper on the map in terms of these Jeopardy All-Star games. But I think he and Jennifer Giles, maybe Anna Lynn and Monica Chu, although maybe they're in their own like tier between the bottom and whatever's above them, I think those four maybe are a cut below the rest, sadly.
Okay, so we still have, just for my own information, I am deciding between Team Buzzy, Team Austin, and Team Colby.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Wow. I gotta be honest, I am somewhat surprised. I mean, it just goes to show how many loaded teams there are. I can't believe some of these players are still on the board here. I am agonizing over this decision. I guess I got to go with Survivor fan Alex Jacobs' team. Give me Team Buzzy along with the aforementioned Jennifer Giles to round that one out. We've talked about Alex a little earlier in terms of him being the number one overall pick, even above Roger Craig, and you know, despite Roger's killer resume and potentially being one daily double clue away from winning that match against Ken and Brad, where he was all in and got, for the first time in his life, a daily double question wrong. If he gets that right, I think it's a completely different ball game, especially when both Ken and Brad missed that final Jeopardy at the end of the episode. But Alex Jacob went number one, even above him, and I have to imagine that's not an accident. When Buzzy got the number one pick, I'm sure he had his draft board ready, and the reason he gave was Alex is very fast on the buzzer, which is going to be a big difference maker when so many people up there know so many things. But the most important thing, Dom, and something that I'm shocked hasn't come up yet, is, as I alluded to, Alex is a Survivor fan and thus has immaculate taste and should be drafted much higher than this.
Yeah, and back when I was taking an interest in poker, which is how I met you back in 2010, Alex Jacob was already one of the big names in that community too. So whatever interest I have, it seems like he's been just either directly in the center or at least in the orbit of whatever it is I've enjoyed looking at. So hard to root against someone like that. In our own dealings with him, he's always been a really easy guy to support and root for, very interesting to talk to. So just on that basis alone, we have a maybe a little bit of bias there, but yeah, in terms of
Dom was calling him AJ earlier, which I thought was a little
familiar.
Yeah.
But in terms of pure Jeopardy stats, he's just a machine. Like his regular season run was very impressive, and then when he came back for the Tournament of Champions, he just steamrolled over the competition. It didn't even look close. It was like you wouldn't know from watching that it wasn't All-Star game, because he just made it look that easy.
Right. And I mean, first of all, I think Dom somewhat undersold Alex Jacobs' background in poker. He was one of the original online poker just mega crushers back in the like mid-2000s, and was, I would imagine, like a self-made multimillionaire by the time he was in his early 20s. And it seems like he went from poker into some other industry, I think it's like finance, almost, as far as I can tell, a lot of people who just destroyed online poker back in the day seemed almost like it wasn't enjoyable, like it wasn't hard enough for them, and they had to go challenge themselves in some other field. And I think Alex may, to at least potentially some extent, have had that going for him.
I think he's one of those guys who just crushes anything he puts his mind to, and the only limiting factor really is when he gets bored and decides to move on to something else. But if you think I undersold his poker credentials, Jeopardy itself definitely undersold them.
That's what I was going to get to, yeah.
Yeah, when they were doing these mini interviews during the live draft, Alex presented it as, oh, you took some of your winnings, and with the luxury that afforded you, you became a semi-professional poker player, which I guess is... The issue there is with the became, not with the semi-professional now, because...
He was like, Trebek's like, Alex, I hear after Jeopardy you've taken up poker? Is that right? And Alex Jacob, this like true legend of the game, of the online world at least, is like, yeah, you know, I dabble from time to time.
Yeah, he tried to explain it, and then there was some microphone issue, which meant he couldn't fully do that. And by the time that was resolved, Alex had already moved. Alex Trebek, I mean, had already moved on to something else. So he never got to set the record straight there. But anyone who was in any way familiar with online poker back in, you know, 10 or 15 years ago will know the name and fear the name Alex Jacob. And so I know back on like 2+2 or in the social circles that we run in, when it turned out that Alex Jacob was actually going on Jeopardy, and you saw that photo of him with Alex Trebek's hand on his shoulder, it was like, these people don't know what they're getting themselves into. And sure enough, he became a superstar in this world as well.
Yeah, story checks out. He also is a Yale alum, a much better school than Oxford, so he's got that going for him. So
of course,
count that. And do we know anything about Jennifer other than that she came in through the teachers' tournament?
Not at this point, although I hope that we are all forced to know something about her by the end of this. I hope that she can compete with the rest of them here.
One thing I wanted to follow up on from earlier to kind of go back to the team captain here that we haven't really touched on to this point is Buzzy. We talked a little bit about potentially Buzzy and Austin in particular benefiting from some sort of like recency bias in terms of picking who would get to be a captain if you're the producers. How familiar are you with Buzzy in terms of him as a player? Because it sounded to me like you were thinking, as this is back when we were talking about like the conspiracy idea, that he may have been one, that he and Austin may have been like the weaker captains in your mind.
I think they are the weaker captains, but maybe the bigger personalities, and that's what gets them those spots. And Buzzy, his stats are impressive in their own right. I mean, nothing to no shame in that at all. But I think he gets to be the top of the ticket because of he is Buzzy, the Jeopardy character, rather than like Alex Jacob, the Jeopardy crusher.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I don't like I.
Because if you look at the other captains, you have Ken and Brad there, you have Julia, you have Colby. Buzzy and Austin, you know, personality-wise, I think fit maybe better in there than Roger and Alex, who, for all of their incredible Jeopardy skills, are fairly quiet guys, maybe a little introverted. They're not going to be giving interviews with the same, you know, bluster and panache as someone like Buzzy and Austin do completely naturally.
I totally agree with that. And I don't at all want to write off the idea that just because they're recent, like I don't want to, I guess, convince myself of the idea that it could only be recency bias. I did not watch a ton of either of their games. I've seen a little of them from various clips that I could find, but I didn't like watch their runs. I am still totally open to the idea that despite the fact that they've only been playing Jeopardy for a year or whatever, they could still be among the all-time greats and totally hang in this tournament. I don't think they would consider putting people in this captain role that they didn't think that was at least a possibility for.
Yeah, I think normally you would look at someone like Roger Craig or Matt Jackson or Alex Jacob, these guys who maybe are not the most like braggadocious of the bunch, but who put up the best results, and think they're most likely to be underrated based on their quiet personalities. When in the circles of rerunning, it might go the other way, where we're likely to, if anything, over assign the sense of like mystery and savantism to people like that. And the louder guys, like the Buzzies and the Austins, it's easy to write them off as, oh, well, they're just loud and that's why they are getting all this attention, when actually beneath the bluster, maybe they are just crushing it too and doing it quietly, but just in a different sense.
I would love for you to remember that sentiment next time you think I'm just loud and obnoxious. And I would love to just replay that audio.
This is entirely self-contained and has no relevance to any other sphere of life whatsoever. And that's my official ruling. Yeah, I think Buzzy and Austin, if we're grouping these people together, so I tried to do that with the Alex Jacob, Matt Jackson, Ben Ingram trio, maybe with Roger Craig adjacent to that. I wonder if Buzzy, Austin, and also Seth Wilson is worth lumping in there too, when somehow Buzzy and Austin get to be team captains here and Seth Wilson languishes as a third round draft pick or second
round.
Right,
that's when I said I would not have been shocked at all based on what I remember of Seth Wilson. If captain might have blown my mind, but certainly first round pick would not have.
Yeah, and if you just look at the stats, I think if you shuffled them around and said, okay, one of these is Buzzy, one is Austin, one is Seth Wilson, I don't think there would be much to give between the three of them. I think you would easily make the mistake of assigning their individual records to any of the others.
Totally. Yeah, so there is Team Buzzy, and I think I'm very happy with getting Team Buzzy here with the, what is it, fourth overall pick. I thought that was a possibility. I guess I had the first overall pick, but I certainly thought that was a team that could easily go in your first set of picks.
Okay, so to me, the reason that I badly wanted to be B within this format is that I think there is a clear last pick, and I think Team Buzzy and Team Austin are effectively interchangeable in terms of both their team captains, their first picks, and then also their second picks. So just getting one of those two would be fine with me, whichever one it was. It's maybe worth getting into. Which of Alex and Roger would you rather have on your team if you had your druthers?
Because, I mean, this is how I'll answer that question. It is absolutely within the realm of possibility, not just for Alex Jacob, but for Matt Jackson and Ben Ingram and Seth Wilson and maybe, you know, Buzzy and Austin, and take your pick out of people who are not named Ken and Brad, frankly. I am all ears in terms of 10 years from now, it turns out the best Jeopardy player of all time was one of these people that has not really established themselves in that upper echelon just yet. And it is absolutely like within the realm of possibility that Alex could be that person. But based on what I know today, to go back to like I just how floored I was to not see Roger as a captain, I don't think there's any question that Ken and Brad are the easy like top two names and career records in the history of Jeopardy, and no one else just is really in that conversation with them. But what I have seen with my own eyes is Roger Craig behind that third podium, putting himself in a fantastic spot to win a tournament of Jeopardy in a finals against Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter, potentially the two greatest Jeopardy players of all time. And until I see Alex Jacob at least do something close to that, I would not be comfortable saying that I would take Alex over Roger.
I would completely co-sign all of that. If Roger Craig remembers the word Manitoba, then the entire history of Jeopardy for the past like 5 years is written completely differently. So I think Roger is, I guess, a safer pick in one sense. And it's weird to say safe pick against a guy who is shoving his entire sack at every possible opportunity when $1 million is on the line. But I think he is, just in terms of like epistemology, right? Where we know what Roger is capable of. We don't know fully what Alex Jacob is capable of. We don't know where his ceiling is. What we have seen from him is incredibly impressive, and it would not surprise me if he could just shatter that glass ceiling and break into that tier with Brad and Ken, who I would agree at this point are 1 and 1A in some order. And that's like the Will versus Dan of Jeopardy, right? Like, that's the debate which will rage forever. I would buy that Alex Jacob or Roger Craig is the Derek, but maybe they have outs to be even better than that.
Yeah. Which one are you, by the way? Who in your view is the greatest Jeopardy player of all time?
Well, I'm not sure which of Will and Dan is a better Jeopardy player, but out of
well,
Ken
one is
Brad,
a doctor and one is a life coach, so I think
yeah, maybe that one's not so close there. But out of Ken and Brad, until Brad loses a game to a human, I'm gonna have a hard time awarding it to anyone else, frankly.
Yeah, I am with that as well. But to just wrap up on that idea on Roger Craig, there's just nothing anyone else could do to compare to having the experience that Roger has playing the highest pressure game of Jeopardy that's ever been played against the two toughest competitors in the history of the show. And again, putting himself in at least theoretically a fantastic spot to go home with that title. Having not seen anyone else play, for the most part, at least more than once, it's just impossible to be in that same conversation for me.
Yeah, despite Austin's questionable logic for picking Roger, the act of picking Roger is a slam dunk when he is still on that board there. And do we agree then that given that Buzzy and Austin are captains, and given that Alex Jacob and Roger Craig are in the pool of candidates here, they have to be the first two picks?
I didn't think it was a foregone conclusion that Alex Jacob had to be in the top two picks necessarily. I thought Roger would be the no-brainer number one pick, and I could have seen the second pick going a couple of different directions.
So do you think it's an outright mistake then for Buzzy not to pick Roger?
It's No. I certainly don't want to come on here and say what a moron Buzzy is for not taking Roger Craig. I'm sure Buzzy had plenty of reasons, and Buzzy did a lot more research than I have in terms of his draft board here. It goes back to what I've said before, which is I think experience is a factor here, and I know Roger Craig has performed really well in the highest intensity Jeopardy situations that have ever been concocted.
Right. But looking at those two teams, do you agree with me that Buzzy and Austin, maybe there's not too much to give between the two of them, although Austin's record speaks for itself, and then Alex and Roger are 1 and 1A in their own like little subcategory, and then with Leonard Cooper and Jennifer Giles, I would rather be on the Leonard Cooper end of things there. So between Team Buzzy and Team Austin, I don't think there's too much difference, but let me know if you disagree.
Well, as mentioned, Alex Jacob is a Survivor fan, which is what tipped the scales.
Sure, but personal bias and or investment aside, I think that the two teams, there's not a massive gulf between them.
I totally agree with that.
Okay, but I think there is a big gulf between them and the last place team here, which you will be saddled with. Although, again, maybe that's an unfair word to use here, with Team Colby, who consists of Colby Burnett himself, his good friend Pam Mueller, and then Alan Lin rounding out the team here.
Yeah, and I'm totally fine. I had a feeling this may be the team that would fall to me. Quickly, do we know much about Leonard? We kind of skipped over him a little bit, but for a young guy, seems as promising as we could hope for.
Man of mystery, great hair. Nothing to fault the guy for at this point.
Yeah. So to go to now the final team, Colby, you just ran it down, Pam Mueller and Alan Lin, which will be joining up on my squad. I think in looking at this team, I wasn't super familiar with Alan, certainly familiar with Colby and Pam. I feel like this is a fairly balanced team as well, although it's just not the same caliber of player across the board, I would say. This is like Diet, Brad, Larissa, and David Madden.
Okay, now that's an interesting comparison.
Or, I mean, take your pick. Who was the, what was the, Julia, Ben, and Seth Wilson?
Are you just comparing Larissa and Pam because they're female?
No, I'm not. Hey, substantive? All right, okay, okay. No, I think this is a team that I don't see any major weaknesses by any stretch. It just doesn't have that same kind of star power in terms of records that pretty much every other team has.
Yeah, Colby might have the more storied history with the Jeopardy franchise, but I think Pam might be the best player on that team. Like, she has been in the Super Tournaments before and held her own. She's made it to the semifinals each time, I believe. And you're not going to hear like much bragging from Pam. She's not one of these bigger personalities, but she always shows up and puts the work in and does a decent job of it.
I actually think, to go back to that idea of Ken and Brad and Julia having lifetime passes, I will never be surprised to see Pam Mueller pop up on Jeopardy tournaments. I think she has easily cemented herself above pretty much all of the other female icons other than Julia.
Yeah, and Colby has a Tournament of Champions title under his belt, but it's always tough to divine exactly what that means, because depending on the cycle that you play in, sometimes you get the Arthur Chu, Julia Collins, Ben Ingram Tournament of Champions, or you get one of these tournaments where maybe there's one or two other contenders for the throne, but if you can fend them off, then you have an easy path to the $250,000.
I don't know off the top of my head, but that's got to be the most loaded Tournament of Champions final, right? I am sure Jeopardy fanatics out there can correct me on that, but the one you just ran down, Ben, Julia, and Arthur, is insane.
It has to be, yeah, and I think there are only two tournaments on Netflix at this point, and that's one of them. It's the 2014 Tournament of Champions.
Oh, awesome. I'm going to watch that at some point. Probably could have done that before doing a podcast about Jeopardy and several of the players involved. There is Colby, Pam, and Alan coming onto my team. And actually, one thing that we wanted to get to, and now that Arthur has come up just in passing, seems like a decent enough time. Where is Arthur Chu, and who are the other notable snubs, if any?
It's unclear if he was offered and turned it down, or they just didn't want to entertain all the controversy around him by having him there in the first place. Could believe either, would believe either. Not too sad not to see him there, although certainly if you were just doing it purely based on stats and history within the franchise, he would deserve a spot. But it does, outside of that, I can't really think of any notable snubs. You could say that anyone before 2000 is a notable snub based on when they decided to draw that boundary. But within that time frame, I'm not sure who really should be there, who isn't. I guess Stephanie Jass may have earned a spot, but then disowned it or unearned it herself with her extracurricular activities. So outside of that, I'm not sure who is really missing there.
Yeah, there was a time where Ian Terry had like a comprehensive list of all the Jeopardy players from every year, and I'm sure he could give us a rundown of all of the notable snubs here, but I am fresh out. What else, Dom? I guess we have done picks in the form of a draft, but there may have been some strategic picking going on there. Now that that is all in the books, are you sticking with the team you pick first overall to be your eventual winner pick?
So Team Julia?
Yeah.
I think the team with the single highest amount of equity was always going to be Team Brad, and in fact is Team Brad. But I think the combined Team Julia and Team Ken was enough to move the needle in that direction. But it would not shock me if Team Brad, and therefore, sadly, Colin Stone, are taking home the title when all of this is said and done.
Whoever wins this is going to be undefeated in Jeopardy drafts for so long.
Oh God, yeah, I didn't even think about that angle. But one thing that that does come up here, we mentioned Julia and Ben playing in the same cycle. The two of them are close friends outside the show now. They've played together, so they have good knowledge of how the other one plays. Do you think that really factors into, maybe it doesn't factor into the draft picks based on who's left on the board, but just in the way the game is going to play out when you have to make these decisions as a team of who's going to go and when, it does help to have a good understanding of what are your own strengths and weaknesses, but also what are my team members' strengths and weaknesses. So do you think that is going to have a material effect, or is it just a nice tiebreaker if it comes down to that?
I'm guessing that it's basically just going to be process of elimination of who are the two people we want playing Double Jeopardy, generally speaking.
Sure, but for someone like Colby, for instance, who this seems to be a bigger bar to his own mentality, I think he picked Pam not because he thought Pam is definitively better than Larissa Kelly, David Madden, Seth Wilson, but because he has this history with Pam going back many years. She's his close friend, and therefore just having her there is going to be a bigger boon to him, certainly in Jeopardy terms, but also just in terms of personal enjoyment
totally,
than anything else.
Yes.
Okay, but is that completely unwise then, or... like, how big of a factor do you think that should play in your decisions there?
I think in particularly Colby's spot, he had a lot of different picks he could have made, and maybe it was a bit of a reach for Pam, but I think that is totally fine in terms of wanting the tiebreaker to be how well you think you two could work as teammates. I think having someone on your team where you know their strengths inside and out and they know yours could be really beneficial in ways we potentially don't understand yet.
And it wouldn't shock me if Pam was hoping to be picked by exactly Colby rather
right.
than any of the other captains there.
And I would imagine plenty of these people are super friendly. I mentioned before, I'm pretty sure Alex Jacob and Ben Ingram have been friends off air, I guess, so to speak, for a long time. And I'm guessing just at this level of trivia ability that it's a pretty tight-knit community.
Oh, I have to think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So what else, Dom?
So I guess instead of looking at our own draft and looking at the one that they did, what other picks that stand out to you as being like steals or maybe especially bad given the other options that they had available?
None of them stand out as especially bad. I don't think anyone went way earlier than they should have. Other than, like, honestly, the biggest surprise to me, and I certainly mean no disrespect in this way, it's just it blew my mind that Roger Craig was not the number one overall pick.
Sure. And that debate is one that I think will rage
sure.
repeatedly, and the same arguments will be made over and over again. Outside of that, though, this looks like a fairly predictable and sensible draft order. So Alex, Roger, Matt Jackson, Ben Ingram being the first four off the board, they have to be the first four there in some capacity, right?
I agree.
It's a matter of A, B, C, and D. And then you have Colby picking Pam, which maybe throws a wrench in things. When Brad gets to pick Larissa Kelly, David Madden, I think those are easy picks for him. Colby picking Anna Lynn over Seth Wilson is the other face melter. But again, it's Colby who he does his own thing most of the time. If you wipe Colby off there, let's pretend Pam and Anna Lynn weren't on the board, then this is basically the order that you should have, I think, regardless of Roger versus Alex or anything like that.
I agree. And I would say that would be the other notable inflection for me, would be that 8 and 9 swing there for Seth Wilson. I would imagine Julia was very excited to see him not get taken by Colby.
Yeah, the only other thing that I have for now, and I'm definitely down for coming back and doing more Jeopardy coverage as this tournament unfolds and maybe afterwards, and hopefully with some of the players if we can set that up. The only other thing that comes to mind for me is you didn't give your own take on the Ken versus Brad issue. You cleverly dodged that question by posing it to me instead.
Did I? Well, I come down much like on the Will versus Dan debate, and I think that's a comparison I've made before. Like, that's one of my thousands of tweets that got deleted was Ken and Brad are the Dan and Dr. Will of Jeopardy.
Yeah. So, Colin, who is your Andy Heron here?
That's right. Austin is actually the edgelord number one. But no, I think Roger Craig actually would be the Andy Heron candidate potentially. Like, he genuinely was. I know this is super weird for people who didn't see the match in question, but one Daily Double away from potentially entering day two of that showdown with Ken and Brad with up like 40,000 to 0-0 and just having it in the bag. And that is just, as Dom has mentioned, just such an insane kind of sliding doors moment for the history of Jeopardy and specifically the reputation of Roger Craig. But much like the Dr. Will versus Dan debate, I am, until I see Ken beat Brad, firmly team Brad.
Yeah, and it does strike me that for as much as Ken and Brad are both highly entertaining people, I don't know if there's any one singular moment that I would assign to each of them as this is a big step in the history of Jeopardy or this is a thing that they are known for. And I guess when you've played as many games as each of them has, it's easy for all of them to kind of blur together a little bit. So if I ask you to name the players from Ken's 39th game or whatever, like that in itself is a good trivia question, right?
That's a horrible trivia question. Well, no one in the world, Ken Jennings, could not answer that trivia question.
Okay, well, you know exactly what I mean, so don't be difficult. But like the two of them, the point I'm trying to get at is I don't think they have that many big defining moments, whereas for me, if you ask what my favorite Jeopardy moment is, or really one of my favorite TV moments is, Roger Craig just shoving back to back is definitely up there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's just stone cold. So yeah, very excited for this tournament, which as I mentioned, kicks off hopefully tonight at the time that you're hearing this, and otherwise has already kicked off and you may have already seen the entire thing play out, but super excited. I was thinking earlier today, like, the Survivor season premiere may honestly be my third most anticipated episode of TV for that night.
What's the third that's in the mix there?
The Challenge, of course.
Oh, yes, of course. How silly of me. But yeah, Survivor might not actually be the main event, which is... I'm glad that it's less a reflection on Survivor and more how pumped up I am just to see Brad and Ken and Roger and so on back on my screen again. Although if it was a truly great Survivor season, then that was still edited out probably. So I'm hoping that they will be 1 and 1A collectively, and I'm hoping for you that the challenge gets to remain in the mix after tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm. I want to just quickly clarify my previous answer to that Brad versus Ken question, because I don't want to make it sound like I think Brad, because he has yet to lose to Ken, could probably not lose to Ken. I think if they were to play a ton of games of Jeopardy with a random third opponent, I think they would both run just about even. And I think that's the case for a lot of the players in this field. So I definitely don't want to make it sound like I think just because Brad has yet to lose to a human that no human, if this were an individual tournament, would be able to hang with him. Like I said earlier, I actually think it is in the realm of possibility that the best Jeopardy player of all time, we will find out if they do many more of these kind of returning player tournaments over the next couple of decades, could be someone in this field not named Ken or Brad or Julia or whoever else you want to put Roger Craig in that conversation. It could be one of these more recent guys that just hasn't gotten an opportunity to show exactly how dominant they could be, but very excited to get a chance to potentially get the first glimpse of that or some more Brad and Ken dominance as we hit this season premiere tonight. Dom, anything else from you?
Well, I was going to say, just to close this out, do you think Brad ever considers retiring to maintain that unblemished record? Or does he play until someone finally takes a crown from him?
I think he continues going back to Jeopardy every couple of years and cashing another $1 million check. I think that's the game plan if you're Brad Rutter. And frankly, I was kind of joking when I said this earlier, but I am genuinely going to be fascinated by the race between Ken and Brad for Trebek's job.
If someone does finally best Brad Rutter, do you think it is Ken Jennings or what, someone else in this tournament? Or is it going to have to be someone else entirely when Brad is 65 and can barely stand at the podium anymore?
It could be anyone. Listen, it couldn't be me. But anyone who is competing at this level, who is being invited to the same tournaments as Brad Rutter, given just the variance in Jeopardy, especially when you're wagering big, anyone could beat Brad Rutter. Any one of these players could beat Brad Rutter in a game.
Sure, I can buy that. Like, I don't think... Jeopardy certainly is not on the level of chess, where like if your ELO, how do you even pronounce that?
ELO. ELO. You do, I okay. Just say ELO.
Where if your ELO rating is like 300 points below, you are never winning a single game. And it's not like, it's not tennis where if the number one seed plays against the 100th seed, it's just an absolute bloodbath guaranteed. Like, there is a level of variance in this, not just in what clues are assigned or where the daily doubles are, but just what you've studied and what you remember and what within the entire space of human knowledge happens to be featured on this episode of Jeopardy, right?
Right, right. As you mentioned, I mean, that Manitoba clue and him potentially just having an extra 3 seconds could have swung everything.
Right, and so that's an interesting larger point, actually, about how much luck actually plays a role in this game, because you have the mechanics of Jeopardy where you have to pick certain clues at certain times and so on, but there's also just luck in terms of how well you're able to function on any given day, or like, you could scan the entire Jeopardy archive the way that Alex Jacobs supposedly did and that, you know, Roger Craig built a program to do for him, and identify what are the areas of knowledge that tend to come up, what types of questions tend to get asked. You can master all of those things, and then the one thing that your entire game hinges on is something that comes completely out of the blue. And is like, is that lucky? Well, in one sense, you know, luck is heavily involved in that, but it's not in a way that is easy to fit into that definition.
Do we think there are going to be any kind of biases in terms of the types of clues they give? I'm sure they're going to be much harder than average regular person Jeopardy clues with normal contestants, but I would guess, I guess, in just kind of spitballing a potential theory, I would suspect that this kind of like mega tournament would probably, and I'm sure this is something you can look up on Jeopardy archive, and many of these players have, about what the superstar tournaments tend to weight a little more heavily, but I would suspect there's a lot more like history and literature and really deep kind of knowledge stuff that is going to come up here compared to the kind of potent potables you may be used to in the Monday through Friday normal edition.
Yeah, I would be intrigued to see from someone who has done the research here whether these all-star tournaments actually have harder clues and or harder categories on average, or whether it's just more of the same.
Much harder.
You think?
I know. They go out of their way to do it. The Tournament of Champions clues are always harder than the... I'm pretty confident true.
That makes sense, right? That's intuitively what you would expect. But I don't know if it's just a slight step up to the extent where someone who plays on a regular game would have a decent shot of getting those questions too, or if it's going from regular Jeopardy to full-on quiz bowl territory.
So this is what I would say. To go back to your example of Jeopardy not being like chess, and a normal person, as low of a percentage as they may be, would at least have equity against Ken if everything breaks their way, if they're getting average kind of Jeopardy clues where a smart layperson could get a decent enough percentage of them if they could buzz in quickly enough. I would say the more difficult the questions are, and I am expecting these to be potentially the most difficult questions they've ever used, the heavier the favorite would be. Like, Ken would smoke people when the questions are all very difficult compared to things that I could at least potentially make some educated guesses on and get lucky.
I think that makes sense if it's just a pure trivia contest. If you sit down with your piece of paper and someone reads out the clues and you have to, or reads out the questions and you have to get the answers to them, I think that answer makes a lot of sense in that case. But this is a game of Jeopardy where there are these other confounding factors. The main one of which, of course, is the buzzer, which very fittingly Buzzy pointed out that in a game where everybody basically knows everything, the one thing that can break it one way or another is the buzzer. So I wonder if there are people in this contest who have especially good buzzer skills and where that in fact makes them that much more valuable compared to whatever breadth of knowledge they have, which normally would be what elevates them above the competition.
It really seemed like a huge piece of Ken's initial winning streak was he got that buzzer timing down to such an extent and had such an insane base of knowledge for normal Jeopardy clues that whenever Trebek was done reading the clue, he would just automatically be buzzed right in and just assume that he would know it.
Well, that's something that stood out to me about Roger in the Battle of the Decades, actually, is going up against Ken, who was famously good on the buzzer, and Brad, who you could say the same thing about. He was able to get those clues, which it seemed like all three of them knew and were very like ready to buzz in on, but it was him who was able to answer them in the end.
Right. I mean, the reason Watson is the greatest Jeopardy player of all time is not because it's giving such genius answers as Toronto when the final Jeopardy category is U.S. cities. Watson is the best player of all time because it has buzzer priority 100% of clues.
Yeah, and that's why it's, for as much as you can say that, Watson beat Ken and Brad, it is fundamentally impossible to have a fair game of Jeopardy when that will always be a main factor.
Right. Okay, so what else do we have to get to, if anything, here, Dom?
Well, I guess just to follow through on that, like, are there other people who you think maybe are especially bad on the buzzer, or who, where that is going to alter their spot in the power rankings compared to a normal game of Jeopardy?
I don't know who is, but I haven't seen their combine times on buzzer speed. But you are, as we've mentioned a couple times, that was the at least stated reason why Alex Jacob was taken number one overall. So I would at least guess that he is known for his quickness on that buzzer. But I certainly don't know of anyone with like a reputation in the opposite direction. But something I have referenced specifically, I think, with Roger Craig and just the pressure he's played under before and the people he knows that he can compete against, like he knows he can hang in any Jeopardy match against the best players of all time, is I really do think just experience on Jeopardy is going to be a factor. Just having seen as much reality TV as I have, I can't help but think that's going to play a role.
Yeah, there's that for sure. And it's kind of exciting for me, actually, entertaining that question, because let's say Seth Wilson has, unbeknownst to anyone else, just been doing buzzer drills for like 5 hours a day. He might suddenly be the MVP in this entire competition, right? Like if he knows most of the answers and he can show up on game day and steal the opportunity to give those answers away from like Ken and Brad, let's say, then that potentially is completely game changing.
Yeah, I'm certainly going to have my eyes peeled for some eventual kind of future superstars that I'm guessing are going to emerge over the course of this tournament. I think we are going to come away from this with more names in that conversation with Ken and Brad and Roger.
Yeah, and the only other thing that comes to mind, one area where otherwise exceptional Jeopardy players fall down time and time again, is of course wagering strategy, which you would think people who are able to be in this tier would know their stuff on, especially given that it takes maybe 35 minutes to get a comprehensive understanding of every conceivable Jeopardy wagering scenario, which people just don't bother to read before signing up for, which is completely baffling to me, including like multiple time, you know, tournament competitors and so on. But that could be an issue here where, like, not to single them out, but like if Leonard Cooper just decides to, you know, do his thing and make some insane wager, or Jennifer Giles hasn't done her research and you know, make some silly bet, I imagine like Alex Jacob or Roger Craig internally tilting off horribly on the sidelines, just wishing they could step in and stage an intervention.
Yeah, in that capacity, and maybe this is why he went number one overall, I would feel most confident out of this entire field in Alex Jacob when it comes to wagering. I know his math skills are going to be on point, and he will have certainly done his homework in that regard, whereas potentially, if you get Austin or Roger in there, as much as they may know that finding the exact right number may be the best call in the long run, I could see them just going for the biggest number.
Yeah, that's certainly in play. And again, I will prioritize great TV over like GTO wagering or whatever. So I'm hoping we get to see someone come a cropper from that.
Oh, I mean, we were talking to each other watching those Ken, Brad, and Roger Jeopardy matches play out as they were airing live on TV. Like Dom was illegally streaming it in England, like on some sketchy website.
Yeah, and 2 a.m. to get my fix.
Right, and when Roger Craig would land on a daily double, it would be like an, oh my god, what's going to happen kind of moment.
Yeah, it was the ultimate hashtag blindside, and I'm hoping we have some of those installed this season.
Yeah,
season,
definitely.
Tournament, whatever.
This tournament. It's actually not that long of a season. It's only like, what, 2.5 weeks or so? 2 weeks, actually? I think it starts on a Wednesday and ends on a Tuesday.
Does this displace the regular Tournament of Champions for the year, then? Are there people who maybe put in a great performance over the past 8 months who are getting screwed over now by this taking up that slot?
I have no idea, but I suppose check your local listings for more on that in the future.
Yeah, I guess the other concern is that this might become like a Survivor Game Changers of the Jeopardy tournaments, where maybe there was some big blowout tournament scheduled for a year or two down the line, which now that you get to see the big names right now, maybe that gets postponed or cancelled or changes into some different format.
Well, there's no way it's going to be worse than that Watson match, and I, for one, am very excited and very optimistic about watching this tournament play out.
Yeah, and I, for one, I need that immediate gratification, so maybe there could be some better tournament somehow featuring Ken and Brad and friends a few years down the line, but I want it now, goddammit, and that's what I'm getting.
This isn't my ideal all-star tournament, what the fuck?
Right. It's not completely perfect in every way, so I don't want it at all, obviously.
Exactly. Dom, I am fresh out. If you have anything else, now would be the time.
No, I'm good for now. I'm just incredibly excited to watch this in exactly 24 hours now, as it turns out. Or less than that.
Far less than that. It's 1 o'clock in the morning at this
okay,
point.
Okay, well, take two. I'm excited to watch this whenever it happens to be. I'm hoping that you're excited to watch it or to have watched it whenever you're listening to this. But yeah, this is... Yeah, I'm psyched to see Jeopardy back again in some capacity. I'm not someone who watches every day. I'm not obsessing on J-board, like looking over the archives the way that I do with a show like Survivor, but that doesn't diminish my excitement. I may be a casual Jeopardy fan, but I'm a casual in the best possible way, I like to think, at least.
Likewise. So until next time, you can be following Dom on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. And I'm guessing many people hearing this are big reality TV fans in general. And for anyone unaware, we will be kicking off the upcoming Survivor season that will probably have already started airing by the time anyone is hearing this. But that, of course, will be coming regularly on the podcast as well. So subscribe wherever you're hearing this if you want to stay up to date on everything going forward. That's going to do it. Thanks so much for making it this far into a Jeopardy podcast that I thought would probably take, I don't know, 45 minutes, but here we are. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.